Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Uncertainty, self-doubt, stressing about not knowing where to start. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Word art. Sorry, live laugh lovers. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. So, has anyone had walking pneumonia recently?
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Christy. Christy Penley
is that true, Christy?
She's on the rebound. And she did at least one podcast recording with pneumonia, if not two. And also probably worked full time. Yeah. Christy, how are you feeling?
You know what? I'm like 90%. I'm like almost there. So okay. I'm not like fully exercising yet. That's why I say I'm not fully there. Because But coughing a lot less and breathing a lot better.
Walking pneumonia. My understanding is that's like pneumonia, but it doesn't like knock you out. It's like you don't realize that you had pneumonia. You're just kind of walking around with like a cough.
I mean, I definitely realized I had something. So okay. I don't know. People are like, yeah, it's not as bad as pneumonia. I'm like, all right, well, it was bad. I felt like it was crawling pneumonia.
Oh my gosh.
So part of me wonders if walking pneumonia is just pneumonia for people who can't stop going.
Maybe.
Right? Pneumonia for people who are like, I'm not sick. I'm going to get over this quick.
I'm going to preach. It doesn't matter.
That's funny.
It does sound like something that could eventually like grow into the zombie apocalypse, right? Walking pneumonia. And like eventually, right, you turn into a zombie. That would make a good plot for a movie. It's like you think it's just pneumonia and it's like, oh my gosh, it's the zombie virus.
It kind of felt like that, y'all. It did.
All right, well, stay tuned, listener.
All right. Yeah.
Maybe
all
next week.
Next week what?
Christy will be a zombie. And the apocalypse will have started. So who knows?
All right. Well, this is a brain-free eating podcast. We don't support eating brains. So please eat your brains before we record. Ben, how are you? How you been?
No walking pneumonia, to be, to be clear on that. My wife has been sick, though. And so she's had a little cough. She had a little cough and then it like settled into her chest and now she's just like having trouble sleeping and stuff.
Yikes. So
that's pretty tough.
Yeah.
For her. I mean, how I was though, but.
We've been traveling a lot, you and I. We were in DC last week and then we had a clergy conference. So like seven days and we were home for two nights, 8 days we were home for two nights. So it's been a lot.
Yeah. It has been a lot of travel. I feel like I'm kind of, getting over that. It takes it more out of me than it used to as I age, I approach 50.
Come on.
Yeah, a man in your condition needs to reconsider his travel schedule. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are you traveling, Matt? Are you going to Disney soon?
Yes, thanks for reminding me. Look, for somebody who talks about mammon as much as I do, and I got to keep my voice down because my office door is open.
The kids are listening.
It's impossible to quantify the amount of shame I feel having been to Disney as often as I have been.
That's good. This is good. Yeah.
Yep.
It's a good little chastening exercise there.
Well, I'm not sure an Enneagram 4 would want it any other way. I've got a consistent.
It's perfect for you.
Yeah. It's like being waterboarded with shame. And every time I go to Disney, I can't breathe. I'm willing to give up names and social security numbers to anybody.
And you wouldn't have it any other way.
I'll be a foreign agent. We're going to Disney. Not because necessarily,
it's gifted.
It's a gifted vacation.
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Does keep on giving.
Kind of like a venereal disease. Yes. It's a vacation.
Yeah.
STD. You know, I, listener, we should, probably should get the trigger warning out of the way already. If that didn't signal, yeah. We're going to be talking about some difficult things today on the podcast. And so abuse things. So if you need to listen to this when you have more in the tank, or if there's ears listening that this wouldn't be good for, just a heads up.
Yeah.
But.
And obviously you know this, but permission to pause, you know, that's the nice thing about a podcast. You don't have to keep listening. So
you also permission to leave a 5-star rating and a review.
Yeah. I mean, while you're, while the podcast is paused,
I didn't listen to this, but that one of the co-hosts leads with pneumonia. So they're ballers. Yeah, I'm going to Disney. Ben and I are actually going to Nashville in April. I'm kind of looking forward to that, Ben.
We're going to, I mean, we might as well tell people what it's going to be. We're not just going there randomly, but, what's
road
it called?
Trip.
The Post Evangelical Collective Gathering.
Yeah, that's it.
Something like that.
Yeah, that's it.
So yeah, you can look that up, postevangelicalcollective.org. And yeah, I'm actually, oh, they're the National Gathering. It's, you got to scroll down on the website a little bit. Yeah. April 29th and 30th in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah. And we've never been before. We're checking this out. Yeah. Some of our friends are involved, and we just want to try to find new networks, new relationships.
Yeah.
So as best we can.
Yeah.
I did mention gravity in my last sermon.
Okay.
And then people came up to me and they're like, wait a minute. Like, you actually help with the podcast. And then people are like, wait, what podcast? And so we might have some new listeners now.
Well, great. Welcome.
I know.
Welcome, new listeners.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, should we get into our interview?
Let's do it.
We had a little update here, but I'm excited about this. This was a precious time. We're talking today with Cheryl Miller, and she's worked in mediation, restorative justice, and community development for over 2 decades. She's an experienced nonprofit leader who's also the founder of Quantum Circles Consulting and Training, an organization that equips community groups to address homelessness, economic development, restoration, and reconciliation. Today, we chatted with her about her new book, Enough Silence, Creating Sacred Space for Survivors of Sexual Assault Through Restorative Justice. Let's get into the interview. Cheryl Miller joins us today on the podcast. Cheryl, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
You have written this book about victim-offender dialogues and survivor mediation, things like this. And you've done this, you say, for several decades. I wonder if you could just share with us a little bit about how you got into this kind of work. Did you find it? Did it find you? And what's been the fruit of this work in your life? Maybe just reflect on that a bit.
Okay. Kind of both. I found it and it found me. I had been an elementary school teacher and we did a lot of mediation when I was in the school, peer mediation with the students. But then I left that job to become the executive director of a housing program for women that were coming out of the county jail and or prison. And I was there about 3 or 4 months, and somebody contacted me about a restorative justice conference that the previous executive director had agreed to speak on a panel on reentry. And they asked if I would be willing to come and speak. And I said, well, I've only been doing this job for 4 months. And so, but yes, I'll come. So I had never heard of restorative justice. So I went to this restorative justice conference to speak on this panel on reentry. And like any other conference, they have all those booths out there where they're showing things. And I was wandering through the booths and I saw this big banner that said victim offender mediation dialogue. And I was extremely intrigued because it had the word mediation in it, which was one of my backgrounds and passions. And since I was working with ex-offenders, I was like, wow, that's interesting. So I walked up to him and asked him about the program. And it was a representative from the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. And they had just launched this program, VOMD, Victim Offender Mediation Dialogue. And they were about to kick off their first volunteer training. And so I told him a little bit about my background and what I was doing. And he was like, God, you would be really good for this program to be a volunteer. And he said, the volunteers have been preparing for, you know, the last couple of months for this upcoming training. But I think if you call the guy who's in charge of the program, who's doing the training, you know, he might be encouraged. So I called him. This was on a Friday. So I called him that Friday and he said, oh yeah, I'd love to have you in the training. And I said, well, when does it start? And he said, Monday. I was like, yeah. So I had to do some shuffling around because I had young kids at the time, but I ended up going. And at the time it was a 96-hour training. It was 6 days all day long. And then we took a week off and then we came back and did another 6 days. Wow. And so, that's kind of how it started for me is it's like I discovered it. It discovered me sort of at the same time. And all the time I was doing it, I started volunteering then. I was like, what does this have to do with the work that I'm doing at my day job? You know, it's like, because this program was through Victim Services Division of TDCJ. And so it's a very victim-focused program. Has, you know, the offender, of course, is a part of the process, but it's very victim-centered, has to be initiated by the victims. And so I could never really understand for years the parallel between the two. And of course, later on, I figured it out. But that's how I got into it. And so I started volunteering. That was 23 years ago. And I volunteered every year except for one. I took a break for 1 year. And the cases that I mediate are not just victims of sexual assault. I've done capital murder, DWI manslaughter, sexual assaults. So it's a variety of cases. But one of the things that I saw primarily working with survivors of sexual assault was how transformative the process was for them and how damaging the systems can be out there for survivors. And that, not just victims of sexual assault, but a lot of the victims, even the ones that were, you know, that were murder cases, were traumatized by both the system and their faith communities. But the thing that really got me hooked was the very first mediation I did. And seeing the power and the transformation in that mediation, I was like, wow, there's something special in this, something really powerful.
Wow. Okay, before we go any further, can you just double click for a second for our listeners? You used the word restorative justice. Can you give us a brief description of what that is? What do you mean by that?
Okay. In the United States, we have what's called a retributive justice system. And so when the law is broken, what happens is they ask several questions. What law was broken? What's the punishment for breaking that law? And then the one premise is that the punishment has to fit the crime. So that's how our court system works. And restorative justice asks three different questions. It says, who has been harmed, what needs to be done to repair that harm, and who is responsible for repairing that harm. So there's a difference in the human element in the process, because in the traditional court process, it's all about the law. Very often, one of the things that you hear victims complain about is they've lost their face, they've lost their name, because it's the state versus whoever committed the crime. Yeah. So there's no victim involved in it. It's set up to protect victims, but it also, in a sense, can dehumanize them. Mm-hmm. Whereas restorative justice starts with who has been harmed, and that's the victim. And so it's very victim-centered.
Yeah. Yeah. So instead of, I hear you naming, like, instead of the victim just being sort of evidence for the case that the law, this abstract concept, was broken,
right,
the victim is actually centered as, what's more wrong here is not that an abstract law was broken,
right,
but that this person was harmed,
right,
you know. And we could go on and on about that, you know, that, yeah. There's like the absolutizing of the law, right, where it's like what's important is this concept rather than maybe the purpose of a law should be to protect people from harm.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. So,
yeah. And, you know, one of the cases that I had, it was a DWI manslaughter, and the mother of a young woman was killed. And she wrote in a blog, she has a name, say her name. I need you to say her name. Yeah. And so yeah. it brings the humanity back into the process.
Yeah. Yeah. And it probably does not go without saying, so I'll ask the question, like, how is then restorative justice, like, where do you see this in the scriptures? How is this a Christian thing for us to do, not just a maybe a good idea?
Well, one of the things that I talk about in the book, why it's a faith element, is that there are several things that make restorative justice. One of them is direct voice, where the person has the ability to say, this is what happened to me. My voice matters. I want to say what the outcome is. And of course, then another really critical part of the restorative justice is accountability by the perpetrator or the offender. In the book of Genesis, the very first story that we're told about men, people born of man, you know, Cain and Abel, is a murder. It's the very first story is a murder, a crime. And in that, God says, what have you done? Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So not only was there this sense of God acknowledging that this crime had been committed, and he banished the brother. You know, he said, this is your consequences for your sin. But what makes it, I think what makes restorative justice biblical is it goes beyond that. And it says, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground, saying that that voice is important. And then again, in Hebrews, when it's talking about Christ, he said, this is the blood of a better covenant, better than the blood that, of Abel that cries out, you know. So to me, that is one of the places where restorative justice becomes a biblical concept. The other is accountability for harm. I mean, that is all throughout the scripture. You know, it's sin, you know. And if you have sinned, you have to acknowledge, I have sinned and I need to be forgiven for this sin and I need to repent of that sin. So taking responsibility for our harmful actions is a very biblical concept.
Mm. We'll be right back. The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show. I've heard it said too that, you know, justice is making things right. And if you have an 8-year-old and the neighbor steals their bike, what makes it right? You know, and usually the 8-year-old would be like, well, give me my bike back. Restore what I've lost. Versus, well, the eight-year-old's been grounded for 2 months, but you don't get there's no restoration of what you've lost. Yeah. You know,
and if the legal system was enough to facilitate justice, I would not have just been assigned case number 2483.
Oh my goodness.
Because that woman's husband was murdered and he was sentenced to life in prison. If she felt that was justice enough, why did she take it a step further and to say, I need to be able to speak to this person?
Man, there's so much here in terms of how the human being is constructed and how unsatisfactory punishment is to bring resolution. And I want to maybe pivot back to what you said and then forward into forgiveness. I know all three of us are pastors, Cheryl, so we have we have relationships and conversations that are confidential, right? But I'm wondering if you could speak in broad terms, or maybe you could generalize from it. You mentioned that first mediation meeting had you hooked. Could you speak a bit more about what hooked you? What did you experience there that you felt like this is worth giving my time and energy towards?
Well, it's actually in the introduction to the book, but it was a murder case, and it was a mother who wanted to meet with the men who murdered her son, and he was young. I think he was maybe 21, and she had so many questions. And every time I met with her, she would just cry and weep about the loss. And this was 12 years after his murder that we were preparing for this mediation. There were three men who were charged with his murder. One of them received life in prison. These sentences reflect how broken our system is. Remember, I said the punishment has to fit the crime. One of them was sentenced to life in prison, and all three of them participated in the crime. One of them was given 10 years probation, and one of them got off no sentence. And so we were going to mediate with the one who got the 10-year probation, because this was, like I said, it was like 10 years later. He had been out on probation and committed another crime, and he was picked up on a federal drug charge. So he went to the federal penitentiary for 3 years. And when he got out of the federal penitentiary because of that crime, it revoked his probation. So he had to do the remaining 10 years of his probation in TDC, and he was about to come up for parole. So we were going to meet with him first. And he agreed to meet with the victim. He took responsibility. He acknowledged that all three of them were there and participated. And she just wanted answers. You know, she every time I met with her, she wept and she cried, and she just had to know what happened. She had to know what those last moments of his life were like. And I told her to write down all her questions, and she filled like 3 pages of a legal pad full of questions that she wanted to ask him. And so I go and I meet with him and ask him what happens. And he describes his horribly brutal murder of what they did to him. Like, they beat him, and then they tried to get rid of his body, but then he came back alive. And so then they beat him some more until he was dead. I mean, it was terrible. And I remember walking out of the prison, hearing that story, thinking, how in the world am I going to bring a mother here to hear something like that about her baby? But as soon as I thought it, I knew it wasn't my choice. It's her choice. And so we get through the mediation, you know, we get ready for the mediation. I set the whole day aside because she has all these things that she wants to ask. You know, she was very active in her church. You know, she was a woman of faith. And we get to the mediation. Like I said, we had the whole day prepared. She starts asking her questions. He answers all her questions. And within about an hour and a half, she says, okay, I think I'm finished. And I was like, what? And this was my first mediation. And so I thought, oh my, I haven't done a very good job. She doesn't feel safe here. She wants to leave. I was supposed to create this safe place for her where she could get all the answers. And I said, well, are you sure about that? She said, no, I'm pretty sure. And I said, well, why don't you just read through your questions one more time to make sure you haven't forgotten anything? And so she's reading through all her questions, and she looks at me. She says, no, I don't have anything else to say. And I felt terrible because I thought I had let her down. And she didn't get emotional at all. It was the first time I'd ever seen her without having any emotions. And so I just felt like I had really failed her. So we shut the process down because she wanted to. We did our debriefing, and then we left. And I called her the next day, which is a part of the process to check on her. And I said, well, how are you feeling? And she said, well, I don't know how to explain it other than maybe it's like there's been this boulder sitting on my chest for the last 10 years, slowly crushing the breath out of me and crushing the life out of me. And now it's gone. And I was on the phone thinking, what? Were we in the same room? I didn't see anything like that happen. But because she had the answers and she was able to ask the questions that she needed and get the answers that she needed, it was transformative for her. And when I went to see her the next time, you know, I asked her about that. And she said, well, you know, you have to realize that I had all these scenarios playing in my brain of what could have possibly happened. And once I knew what the real one was, it was time I could put that to rest. And she said, and I was sitting in church at church on Sunday, and it was, and I looked up at the cross and I thought, it's time to set my baby on the cross and move on for the next chapter. And I walked away from that experience with two really profound insights. One of them was, I don't know what just happened, but this woman was slowly dying and couldn't breathe for 10 years. And in an hour and a half, she can breathe again and she feels like she can live again. Hmm. There's something powerful there. The second thing that occurred to me was, she was sitting in that church for 10 years. She could have been down the pew from me. And nobody in that church provided her the support, the help she needed. It was a volunteer from the Texas Department of Criminal Justice who facilitated her healing. And not to say that the church could have done that, but I came away and have heard so many other stories where I recognize the church has failed survivors of trauma miserably so many times, and something needs to be done about it. So that's why I wrote a book.
Yeah.
I'm glad you did. I think, unfortunately, the church and people in the church have done a lot of harm because we haven't known, we don't know what to say, we don't know what to do. And you actually have a chapter on choosing words wisely, which I think is really helpful, because I think most of us have been in situations where we've either tried to help someone or someone's tried to help us and the wrong thing was said. And then that created unintended harm.
Right.
So could you just give us, what are some guidelines, some pro tips that you can offer us that when we're in a situation of what to do, what to say, and you can pick the topic, whether that's sexual violence or if there's, another way to be more general?
Well, I think the most important thing is just to listen. You know, if somebody's willing to talk, I mean, it's as simple as, Do you feel like sharing about that? Can you tell me about that? And then just listen without judgment, you know? That's the hardest part for people, is to listen without judgment, because we always, you know, we either want to start making our decision about what they did wrong or what they did right, and so we're processing that, or we're trying to start coming up with solutions. And nine times out of 10, survivors don't need your solutions. They really don't. They just need somebody to listen and support them. And that's what I do when I come in for mediation. I walk in and I say, so tell me what happened. And then they just start opening up. And they'll say things like, well, I know this probably sounds crazy. And I'll just, to me, the things you can say is reassure them what they're feeling is okay. Reassure them that you're there for them. Say, you can even ask, is there anything I can do to help? Probably what the answer you're going to get is no, but thank you for listening, that type of thing. So really just providing as much support space as you can in your language is helpful.
Yeah. I've sort of come around back to that question, Christy. I've got into the habit because somebody did this for me and I remember thinking that was so helpful. I'm going to do that for others. And it was essentially, I want to listen to you right now. If there's anything else you need from me, let me know.
Yeah.
And then I don't feel like I have to do anything that I've assumed responsibility for. And I've empowered them to ask for what they need, if they need something more than that. And usually people say, I just need you to listen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's easier to say what not to do than it is to say what to do. Yes, because what to do is variant based on the conversation you're having, you know. But there's a lot of things you don't want to do that aren't based on conversation. Like you don't want to say, oh, I've experienced that before too. Even if you have, there's no value in that because your experience is not going to be the same. But this is a different topic, but my son was in a really bad motorcycle wreck and they gave him a less than 1% chance of living. He ended up recovering and he's completely fine and normal now. He's a walking miracle. But when I got home from being with him for 2 months, somebody came up to me and said, oh, I know exactly how you feel. My son was in a motorcycle wreck and he broke his leg. And I was thinking, really? You think that's the same as the trauma that I just went through? And that's like a mini version of what a lot of survivors experience, trying to say, I understand what you're feeling. So I always lead with, I have no idea what that feels like. I can't imagine what you're going through. Is there anything I can do to support you?
Yeah. Well, and sometimes just being present with people offering space for them to talk. I was recently in a situation where there was a tragic death, and I happened to be one of the first people on the scene. And I asked these students that were standing there, do you want to tell me what you saw, what you heard? Can I give you a hug? Those sort of things. And there was one particular girl who I think was just in real shock. Nothing, nothing, nothing. I don't want to talk to you. But the next day I was at a meeting with these students again, you know, just standing there. And that same girl came up to me and said, can I have a hug now? Can I talk to you now? And I think just being present and not having an agenda, just being able to listen and not judging what you're saying is so important.
Yeah. And because in telling the stories, two things happen. When they're talking, one of the things that happens is there's this ability to try to reclaim some kind of balance and normalcy. Like, I'm going to process what happened to me and try to find meaning out of it. So allowing people to talk is creating a space for them to regain some balance and regain some meaning and regain some control over their situation. The second part of it is it's also very empowering for a lot of people, not for everybody, but for a lot of people, because in telling their story, you realized, wow, I survived that.
Yeah.
Wow. You know? I'm still alive. And that's the other part of the restorative justice process and the VOMD process that really intrigued me and continues to this day is the amount of trauma human beings can experience, the devastating, like some, I've heard some of the most devastating stories you can imagine, and the human abilities of resilience to overcome that extreme trauma and to not only survive, but to go on and to live and to love and to forgive. Yeah. Human beings are capable of so much more than we give ourselves credit for.
Yeah, that's really inspiring, Cheryl. You know, it sounds like you do a lot of mediation. You do a lot of kind of work with various kinds of trauma, but your book is specifically about sexual assault and victims of that. And you use the term sexual violence in your book. And I wonder if you can maybe just give us a definition of that. What do you mean by that term? And then how can we, I don't know. I think I've met a lot of people that, you know, I start to hear their story as a pastor and they don't describe what they've experienced as violent or as abusive. But I think I'm hearing it and I think, you know what, like, I think you need to realize that you were abused here or this was not right, you know, that kind of thing. So I wonder if you can just help us frame for us how prevalent is sexual violence in our society and what do you mean by that term?
Well, it's extremely prevalent in our society. You know, I found that out as an elementary school teacher. You know, I think my third year of teaching, 30% of my students, I had to report to CPS. Wow. And so it's way more prevalent than we would like. And sexual assault, I mean, it has a term as far as the law is concerned, you know, sexual assault, rape, those types of things. But if you use the word sexual violence, it allows people to frame their experience from their perspective. For example, one of the students that I was talking about came to me after her Valentine's party to tell me that she had been raped. And so I was like, oh my gosh. So I started the process of reporting and learned how horrible the system is. And, you know, she was terrified because the offender was still out. Well, when it actually came to, he ended up getting arrested and charged and did probation for her crime. But when it actually came time for her to be interviewed by, you know, the authorities, it was actually molestation. It wasn't rape. He had molested her, which was, she didn't have the words for that. But it was still violence. It was still trauma. And so using the word sexual violence allows people to identify their harm and their trauma on their own terms. Hmm. And, you know, and when you said that about, you know, about hearing something and their people might be minimizing their experience, one of the ways to kind of navigate a conversation like this, you may have done this, is to say, you know, what would you describe that as? Because pointing out to, I mean, if they're not naming it as violence and they're not naming it as a sexual assault, you naming it could be traumatizing. So asking questions that kind of help them see it in a different light and let them come up with that language on their own is way more helpful for them than, you know, just trying to give them that insight. I mean, from a layperson's perspective, now, if you're talking about criminal aspects and stuff like that, you would have to call it what it is. But
yeah, that's really helpful.
And now a word from a sponsor.
Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker.
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%, vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Before we turn to part three of your book, Cheryl, which is describing in some ways toxic cultures and how to build more healthy ones, I wonder if we could just take a moment to talk about forgiveness. Something that I've run into a lot personally, I've had people do this to me, and I think I've done this to others, is moving into mediation situations with the expectation or assumption that forgiveness is required and is the only sort of legitimate, valid Christian outcome.
No.
And I know you know this, but and our listeners know this, so I'm speaking this maybe for some validation here. Stories are legion about how forgiveness is used as a cudgel to get survivors to sort of pay the cost of what their offenders have done before they're ready. Could you talk us through, like, how do we navigate this concept of forgiveness in situations like sexual violence or mediation situations? What's a better way to approach that?
Well, we don't even bring up the word forgiveness in the process. It's not relevant in the mediation process, because what's relevant is what the victim wants to get out of it, what the survivor wants to get out of it. If forgiveness is a part of their process, then we talk about their forgiveness. But if they never bring it up, I never bring it up. But that's also not in a faith context either. You know, that's through TDCJ. And so that's why I call forgiveness the F word, you know, because it's a very touchy process. And I know I've experienced this myself. You know, I'm a survivor of sexual assault. And so I know that, you know, I know what it feels like to be beaten over the head with the Bible saying you need to forgive. And it's like, I'm sorry. I just am not there. You know, I can't do it. There's no way. And there are multiple victims that I've worked with who have not forgiven their offender, have gone through the VOMD process, found it very powerful, very healing, bringing new life, and they still weren't ready to forgive. So for me, I've always described forgiveness more as a journey for people to discover independently on their own, and they're going to figure it out on their own, and nothing anybody else says or does is really going to get them to that spot. I mean, if they ask you about it, you know, if they ask you for, you know, insight, how do I forgive or that type of thing, that's one thing. But probably most of the survivors or victims that I've worked with around the issue of forgiveness have had the same experience that I had, which was being beat over the head with a Bible saying you have to forgive. If you don't forgive, you're not going to be forgiven and you're not going to be healed. You're not going to be whole. And that's just not true.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. What struck me about that first meeting that you were at was how the person whose daughter had been murdered left that meeting feeling this release, this weight, this giving over that many of us as Christians would describe as the fruit of forgiveness.
Right.
But it was never an expectation or an outcome or an obligation going into that meeting for her. And I wonder like if that isn't something for us, that if we do some faithful work of processing hurt, telling the truth about it, doing some of the things you talk about in your book, if forgiveness is like less of like a task and more of like a natural outcome.
Right. That's why I call it a journey, because you kind of arrive to that conclusion, you know, where you're like, okay, this is the next step. To be honest with you, I don't know if that woman forgave him or not. I don't even remember. I don't remember if she told me that she forgave him or not, either at that time or afterwards. It just wasn't a part of the process. But then I've seen it where it's the driving factor of why they want to meet with their offender, because they do want to tell them that they're forgiving them. And they do want to say, I need you to know that I forgave you about this. And so for, you know, it, everybody experiences forgiveness in a different way.
Yeah. Well, if we could turn maybe to part three, you talk about how toxic culture contributes to the occurrence of abuse and sexual violence. And so I wonder, what are some ways that we can work to ensure our culture, that they're more safe for those who are vulnerable to abuse?
Well, start learning about it. Start learning about what a toxic culture is. Start learning about what patriarchy is. Mm-hmm. Looking into what are the structures that we have in place. Are we listening? Are we providing direct voice to people? Are we listening to the people that are around us? Does our leadership reflect? Does our leadership reflect the people we serve? You know, the church that I was in for several years as I was processing my own journey in, you know, as a survivor, it was a very toxic culture. It was a very patriarchal culture. It was a very sin-oriented, fear-driven kind of culture. And, you know, I can remember being in a class, a Bible study class, and the subject came up. And I think I wrote about this in the book, and one of the ladies in there said, well, sexual assault only happens because of sin. You know, if you were a victim of a sexual assault, you had some sin in your life. And I was like, how do we say that in a faith community? You know, mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, that's possible. But how do you explain a four-year-old who's sexually assaulted? Because I've done mediations with, not when they were four, but when they were adults and they wanted to meet with their perpetrators who abused them when they were four. What do you say to a four-year-old? She said, well, then her parents must have had sin in their life, you know? And so there's this victim blaming. And I take, even though it was devastating to hear that, I took that as what that response felt like to me was fear. This is fear. Because that wasn't a random thing that happened. She was sinning. And because of that, she was raped. And if I don't sin, I won't be raped, you know? And if I don't sin, my children won't be raped, and so, or, you know, be abused. And so to me, that I feel like that fear and of sin and all that kind of language really perpetuates toxicity that survivors find it hard to swallow.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Cheryl, there's so much goodness in this book, including creating, you know, as your subtitle says, sacred spaces, how to cultivate spaces that are more allergic to toxicity, right. And how to actively build those. And we'll let the listener get the book for that. I recommend it for those of us who've gone through abuse. It actually helped me be seen as somebody who has PTSD from abuse, wow. But it also, as someone who is a caregiver, it helped me feel more confident about how to move towards people in ways that were faithful and healthy. And I do wonder if you could maybe speak as we close here to those of us who are giving care to others. I don't know, you mentioned over 2,000 mediation relationships in your life. And those of us who are, it could be a parent, it could be caring for an elderly parent, it could be pastor, teacher, social worker. How do you take care of yourself? You hear these stories, Cheryl. How do you take care of yourself? What's good, like emotional, mental hygiene for you look like?
You know, I get asked that question a lot. Or do you ever cry in a mediation? I'm like, of course I cry. You know, I need to cry. These stories deserve my tears. And so I weep over the things that I hear and I mourn them. And then I have kind of But I also have the personality where I can just kind of flip a switch and say, okay, I need to turn this off now. I need to turn this off. And I'll distract myself by doing something else, you know, get on my computer, play a game, you know, watch a movie, bake, something like that. Yeah. So I think part of it, though, I think the piece that's important is giving yourself permission to grieve what you've heard. Yeah. Even if it's not your story, you became a part of the story when you started listening, and you have the right to grieve about what you heard and then move on from there. Yeah. But can I add one more thing about the toxicity that, yes, I think is really important to state? Is if there's ever somebody comes to you, or if, especially if you're in leadership and you hear there's an outcry of some type of sexual violence, for the first step, please believe the person who's outcrying. Don't let your first response be, well, are you sure that happened? Well, or what did you did? Or I don't know that I can't believe that person would do that. Let the first response to believe, wow, I'm sorry that happened. Tell me, what can I do to support you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because more often than not, it's the flip side.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah, it's a good word, Cheryl. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
The book again is Enough Silence, Creating Sacred Space for Survivors of Sexual Assault Through Restorative Justice. Cheryl, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Y'all, I was actually corresponding this morning with two people in my life who are estranged, and one of them wants to move towards mediation or, like, you know, some kind of closure with the other. And one of the things about Cheryl's book in sexual violence, usually there's a really distinct power differential.
Yeah.
You know, and when I'm dealing with more of a friendship or a peer to peer situation, but I'm just realizing how, as I think about how to prepare for this meeting and what is needed to be faithful in this meeting to both of these individuals, I'm just thinking, like, so much of our life is mediating conflict, harm, injustice, trying to be present with people without complicating or triangulating things. And I don't know, just realizing how much of my life would benefit from boning up a bit with this stuff.
Yeah.
Can you guys relate to that?
Yeah, I definitely can. I found myself, as Cheryl was talking, just sort of like, like as she described, like, ways that she would respond or things that she would do, you know, in some of these situations, I did find myself thinking, oh, that's a great idea. You know, like, let's, and some of it does feel like kind of like, I guess you know, maybe reps is how you get that, that kind of, quote unquote expertise, but yeah. Some of it feels like skills that it's like, well, I think I know why I have the impulses I do, maybe to like triangulate or fix things for people or whatever. But it's like, sometimes I do feel that lack of like, I want skills. I want more skills in like what to say that helps me, you know, tell the truth about this situation or leave responsibility in the hands of those it belongs to, you know, like all of that kind of thing.
You know what surprised me is that as Cheryl narrated that encounter between the mom and the person who was convicted of her daughter's murder, that the mom could just bring in questions and just fire away. Mm-hmm. That there wasn't sort of some kind of, like, that really there weren't any rules or, it sounds like, restrictions placed on the person who felt victimized.
Right.
And I don't know. Like, obviously, all hell didn't break loose, but I would have some anxiety about that.
But do you think it's because there had been a conviction? Like, I think a lot of times as pastors, we're in situations where something is happening, and it there hasn't been, like,
there's been an allegation or an accusation, but nobody has said this person's wrong definitively.
Yes, and maybe it's the person who did the crime isn't fessing up, isn't owning up. So then the victim is coming into a situation or talking about the situation as a way of feeling that they have to prove it. Yeah. And in this case, the mom doesn't have to prove a thing because there's already been a consequence given.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'm struck by, though, too.
I think that's wise, Christy.
I think these offenders have to agree to meet with the victims as well.
Right.
So there is a level of, that kind of a thing where, that has to feel like a something that they're willing to do.
Yeah.
But I'm struck by, you know, the victim being able to just ask anything they want. I wonder if there's basically that's part of the power that they're trying to give back, right? Because by definition, a victim is somebody who something bad happened that they were powerless to prevent, or they didn't feel they had the power to prevent, right?
Yeah.
And that, you know, you can ask anything you want is a way of saying, here's some power back.
Yes.
For you in this situation. Hmm. And you don't have to, there's no expectation for like, oh, and you should want to forgive them or you should want to do this or that. It's more like, what do you need? What do you want to ask?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's forgiveness anxiety a lot that I've experienced in situations like this where we want quick resolution or reconciliation. We want to put the bad stuff behind.
Yes.
Yes.
And I, when she mentioned that she allows herself to grieve, I think I have the same anxiety about my own sadness that I do about unresolved conflict. Meaning, I don't want to feel the sadness. I don't want to give. Mm-hmm. I don't want to feed the veracity of it. I kind of want to get over it, stay away from it. You know, tell a joke, put on some music, eat some chocolate.
Well, and that maybe goes back to what you were asking of, like, I want the skills. I want to know how to, mm-hmm. how do I handle these situations? And I wonder if maybe like the best thing we can do to be prepared for situations like that is to take care of ourselves, is to go after our wholeness and our healing so that meet with the counselor, do that, work through your own junk so that when you're sitting listening to somebody else's, you can actually be compassionately curious. You can actually give the listening ear rather than try to fix it or numb it or like whatever the thing is of the ways that we like in an unhealthy way try to honestly power in the situation so that we feel better of somebody else's trauma.
Yeah. Yeah, Christy, I think that's helpful. And I was reminded of something Cheryl said where it's a lot easier to come up with things not to say than to come up with the exact right thing to say because every situation is different. Right. And I'm just struck by, as you're talking, like I'm just struck by how much good work can happen just through the discipline of just refraining from doing the thing you know isn't going to be helpful. And like in that vacuum, like oftentimes, maybe most of the time, nothing actually needs to be done in that vacuum, in that tension, in that uncomfortable space, that just being present, being willing to bear the tension, being willing to bear the discomfort and staying present, oftentimes that's enough without any like special words that you know how to say.
I had a professor who taught me what I call the power of a drink of water. That when I'm in a situation that feels really uncomfortable because someone is sharing something really traumatic or they're like, I want to fix it. I want to like tell them whatever is going on. To just take a drink of water. And he's like, I bring a water bottle to every meeting so that I can practice that. And I think that there's real wisdom in that because it makes you pause. It makes you be silent. It makes you reflect. It makes things slow down rather than try to quick fix something for somebody.
That's good. This is all so good.
At first I thought the drink of water was like a metaphor for something, but no, it's a literal drink of water.
Oh, that's what he was saying. Literal. Yes. Bring my Nalgene.
Yeah.
Well, we're doing kind of a little series here on how to deal with hard stuff in the world. Yeah. Just because I'm hearing from a lot of people that they're experiencing an accumulation of hard stuff. You know, life is hard already, and then you've maybe... I mean, we have people in our church whose funding is being cut for the nonprofit stuff they do. We have members of our church whose themselves or family members are feeling vulnerable to different policies that are happening that are new vulnerabilities. And so I do feel like the suffering that we are experiencing and what we are capable of dealing with, the suffering is increasing. And so our resiliency, our capacity needs to increase too. Yeah. In order to meet that, what it takes to just, you know, function.
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
may it be so.
Christy, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
If one teeth is a tooth and one geese is a goose, shouldn't one sheep be a shoop?
Sure.
All right. Can we decide?
Yeah. I think it's settled.
Okay, somebody there you call go, Webster. Folks. You heard it here. We'll change the dictionary.
Baba Black Shoop, have you any wool?
It kind of makes him, if you call him a shoop, too, like, it kind of makes him seem a little bit more...
musical?
Yeah, shoop-y-doo. Well, kind of like, shoop de wop. You know, like, it makes him seem a little bit, sheep seem a little cooler if one of them is called a shoop. It's like, oh, right. Check out that shoop. No, he's, like, wearing sunglasses. He's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
Oh, that guy.
I think cool. Listeners like cool... thought that my wit was actually more funny. Right there, Matt.
Is it a competition?
Yes, it always. Well, it's a competition for me just to recognize that you're trying to tell me a joke.
I was asking a legitimate question, first of all.
Okay.
Secondly, I scour the internet looking for the worst jokes I can find.
You're so good at that.
Thank you. So it's an anti-competition competition. Okay, you see how that works?
Yes, yes.
A funny story before we go. My wife, when she was a little girl, she used to call one horse, but then if she saw horses, she'd call them heeses.
She did?
Yeah.
Aw, it's so cute.
Kids do those kinds of things where they make up.
Yeah. They learn grammatical rules, and then they apply them in situations that they have no idea they're not supposed to apply them in.
Yeah.
You don't want to correct them. They're stuff. So sweet.
They are really sweet.
And then sometimes they get into your nomenclature as a family and you start calling, like anytime I see a group of horses, I'll call them heeses. When sharing cute. Around, you know, aww. Saddle up your heeses, people.
I love it.
All right. Well, everybody is good. Hey, it's been a while, Chrissy, since we've seen you.
I know. I missed you guys.
So we've been away at Chrissy. We'll maybe talk about this. We may have already talked about this in the intro. We haven't recorded yet. So I won't say anything more about it. But Chrissy's been traveling anyway. Listener, until next time. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out, procrastination, putting it off, kicking the can down the road. In, plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out, carpet in the bathroom. Like, why? In, knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.